Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Bring a little sunshine indoors with the exciting new arrivals in store or online at harrycurry.com.
Hello, good afternoon, and you're very welcome to Liveline. Emily, good afternoon. You say
Hi,
in your.
How are you?
You're good, thanks. You say in your email, dear, but for the grace of God. Go I and your children, but it was some roller coaster of yes, no, maybe, possibly. Take us through your story about the schedule of operations on the hips of your two children, Olivia and Oscar, and what happened and didn't happen and might have happened.
Yeah, so I have three children, and Olivia and Oscar both were diagnosed with hip dysplasia and were under the care of Temple Street. So they were braced. Had about kind of 4 months to treat the initial hip issue. And I guess, you know, as we went through the process of having their hips reviewed, you know, because they're regularly reviewed to see where we are, that we were told that they were going to be put on the surgery list. So I suppose Olivia is the eldest, so she was my first experience of the whole procedure. And, you know, when she first was put into the brace, I questioned whether or not this was necessary even. You know, I was a first-time mum and wanted to know, like, is this necessary? So I had a private opinion and said, yes, she does have hip dysplasia. But I was not getting any major kind of red flags that this was really terrible. So when the prospect of surgery came up, I, you know, of course, was, you know, shocked and upset and all of that. So we were put on the surgery list. We were told to be about 12 to 18 months before you'd be called for surgery. And that was kind of coming up to the time that she would have been due to start in junior infants. And we were also told that this kind of needed to be done, you know, before she turned kind of 5, developmentally speaking, in terms of just the trajectory of hips. So, you know, I was kind of anxious about all of this and, you know, weighed up whether or not we would put her into school. You know, should we give her another year Montessori if she was going to have time off for this surgery? Anyway, that's not what happened. We weren't given the opportunity we weren't given the appointment for the surgery until kind of past the time, like it was when she was in junior infants, past what I had thought. And we refused it because I was pregnant with my third child. And had I not been pregnant with my third child, you know, we may well have gone ahead with it. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I have always been very cautious around the whole thing because I just felt I never got straight answers when I was going through the whole system and the whole process. And then similarly with my son, he was offered surgery in August last year and we were away on holidays and we got the call to say, you know, we have had a cancellation, you know, could you come on Monday kind of thing. I can't remember exactly the days and the timeline, but it was very short notice. And we were still on holidays and we were still to be on holidays whenever this appointment was offered. So I said no because we were away and they said fine, but we were told that, you know, if you refuse it twice, you're taken off the list and you go back to the bottom of the list.
But you were so also told the surgery was minor and keyhole.
I was. Yeah, well, we were told, like I was told that it had gone from major, major surgery and now this kind of the process had been transformed and it was really minor surgery. And, you know, doing my due diligence as a mum, you know, I put the feelers out to people that I knew to see could I find other parents who had had surgeries on their children just to get their experience. And certainly recovery-wise, I was told, you know, 10 days, kind of a week or 10 days on the couch and then up and moving full steam ahead again by 3 weeks. But that wasn't what I heard from others. So, you know, I was really cautious then of, you know, what was this surgery necessary? You know, was I, you know, yeah, like this is a, you know, you're putting your child under general anaesthetic.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, anything that requires it, you don't know how your child is going to respond to general anaesthetic.
General.
You're putting your child under general anaesthetic. You know, no matter how major or minor that is, it's a big decision to sign that paperwork and say yes. You know, and I as a mom have to look at, you know, if they come back to me in years to come, will I be able to stand over to the decision that I made? And the reason I questioned so much was because at no point in my experience, did I feel there was anything coming up that was saying, this is really serious, we need to treat this, this is, you know, we were told on numerous occasions, if you were in any other hospital in the country, you would have been discharged by now. But we see children throughout the lifespan, and, you know, we see people coming in their late teens and 20s with hip issues because they were discharged. You know, so in my mind, I was like, well, that's great in one sense, but also that gives me cause for question. You know, actually, you telling me that I'm, if I'm in any other hospital in the country, I'm going to be discharged, really gives me a feeling that I need to question this, you know, because I looked elsewhere, I looked outside of Ireland, what were they doing in other countries, you know, the instance of hip dysplasia, the instance of surgery, you know, all of that to try and figure out, you know, were we this kind of, you know, were we at the forefront of this, or was there something else? And I always felt uneasy about it. I'd have conversations with my husband and my mum saying, it just doesn't seem like, you know, one of the doctors asked me at one of the appointments, a junior doctor said, you know, what, so, you know, does your child walk with a limp or has one leg shorter than the other or whatever? And I was like, my kids are the kids at the tallest point of the playground, swinging from the rafters. You know, they've no issues. So again, that's something then where I'm like, I have a perfectly, you know, healthy child from my perspective, and obviously you're the person who's looking inside their body and their scans and telling me that they're not. But it just didn't feel right to me.
And that's the trust has been broken down for so many families. And I know you say you checked, but your sting here to say always get second opinions.
Mm-hmm.
But like, as I was listening last week to Katie, a lot of people, and that's this seemed to be the mantra, always get a second opinion from the callers. But it's not everyone that knows how to get a second opinion.
Mm.
It's not everyone that has the confidence. It's not everyone that can write an email. You know what
and
I mean?
It's
not everyone that can take on a medic.
Yes, exactly.
The
and
powerful,
it's not
everyone
who's got the wherewithal to do that.
Yeah,
you know, like
they
might not have the mental space to be, you're going to trust what's being told to you by the person who is the expert in this area. And if that's being told to you, you're going to go with it. And I absolutely hear you when you say that, you know, and there was lots of little things said to me by various people throughout my time that made me question things. You know, in my very first appointment, I was told, I said to the consultant that I met in the first appointment, said, you know, this is necessary. You know, if this was your child, would you do this?
Mm-hmm.
And the person said to me, well, you know, it's up to you. And I was like, so from the get-go, I was like, well, I have to go and get someone else's opinion on this. Like, you're telling me it's up to me. I'm putting a brace on my child here. You know, it's very upsetting. I mean, it's not life and death, but it's upsetting. You know,
and it's stressful and sleep and everything that entails.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let me bring in Hayley. Hayley, good afternoon.
Hello.
Hip surgery in Crumlin. Now, the CHI, this new organisation that was only set up in 2019, they say there is no issue with any of the operations carried out in Crumlin. So it only concerns two hospitals. But the worry is, does that give you any solace?
I mean, it does a bit, yeah. Everyone's looked at the reports and you can, you know, have that as a bit of reassurance for you, I suppose.
Children who had surgery in CHI at Crumlin were found to have been appropriately selected based on current standards used by the auditor. Children's Health Ireland will write to these families to confirm this information. These children will then continue in the normal follow-up processes. Take us through your protocol and procedure and what happened.
So my daughter was 9 months old when the health visitor said that the fat between her at the back of her legs weren't aligned.
Okay.
But when we got seen, she was walking and everything. By then, she was over 12 months old. So we just kept going to see the consultant, and they would say it was very minor and she would more or less grow out of it.
Okay.
And they just kept on monitoring her until we got to a stage where they said she isn't growing out of it. And now it's time to make a decision on whether we proceed with the surgery or not.
Mm-hmm. What age?
She was about 4 by this point.
Okay.
So we obviously, you know, went through the scans and everything with the consultant, and it was decided that we would go ahead with the surgery because, like the other lady, mm-hmm. You know, I trusted what he was saying, and we just, you know, we were told it would be bigger surgery had we, you know, there was still a chance that she might grow out of it, but if she didn't, then we're talking bigger surgeries there.
Mm-hmm.
So we went ahead with the surgery, and it's a major surgery.
Oh, is it okay?
And she was in a big cast. And then she had to relearn to walk again. She was back in nappies. We had to carry her to the toilet. And it was very upsetting.
And does your daughter, how was she afterwards? Does she remember it now?
She does a bit. I mean, she still has a scar, and she has seen photos. But she's not traumatised by it or anything. She knows that she had to have surgery, and, you know, she's a perfectly happy, healthy mm-hmm. child now.
So what communication have you got?
Not much. I've had the same letter that everybody else has had, really. And, yeah, I would really like to have something from the hospital to say if my child has been reviewed and what the outcome of that review was. I feel like we've been left a little bit in the dark here now.
CHI will be in touch with families this week. Crumlin, all found to be appropriately selected for surgery. Does that reassure you? Is this the first you've heard?
Yeah. Only that really, yeah.
And were you... Again, Hayley, we're looking at medics who have to get a certain number of points to go into third level. It's 7 years to begin with. Then if you want to become a consultant, it's at least another 7 years. So that's 14 years. We presume they've had some experience before they start talking to the likes of us. So you automatically assume that somebody, and by the way, they have to pass exams. They have to be validated, verified, tested. So it's an odd question, isn't it, to the parent of a child? It's up to yourself. Sure. When I come back in 21 years, when I've studied everything.
Well, exactly. Yeah. No, I personally just trusted what they were saying to me. They're the medics. They know what they're talking about.
And motive, that's all I'm thinking of. And was it a certain cohort of people who weren't, for various reasons, able to second guess or were lucky enough to have a background or decent education that were, like, people are, I know growing up, we all lived in, the doctor in our area was more revered than the Archbishop of Dublin. You know, he was educated. And anyway, Emily, what's your overall overarching view of all this?
Well, I'm you know, I'm in a position now whereby my son is still on the surgery list. My daughter was taken off the surgery list because at the last appointment I had for her, they said she was staying on the surgery list. And I said, well, can you tell me today, has her dysplasia improved? She's 6 now. She was 5 at the time. Can you tell me, has it improved? And I was told yes. So I said, can you explain to me then why her trajectory is that she's improving continuously, yet we're still on a surgery list? And the doctor left the room and went away and came back. This was a more junior doctor I hadn't met before. Went away and came back and said, we're taking her off the surgery list. So it was just because I continued to ask those questions. So she's off the list. My son is still on the list. And I'm now in a situation whereby I've requested his notes. I've requested all three of my children's notes.
Well done.
And I'm getting a second opinion. you know, I cancelled my last appointment for my daughter, who I was told has, my youngest daughter, who I was told has no dysplasia, but they wanted to continue to scan her. Like, I don't want her being exposed to unnecessary x-rays when she has no dysplasia. You know, I cancelled that appointment after the report was published. You know, but I've gone and I've gotten all three of their vials. I have an appointment privately in July to have their cases reviewed. You know, and now I'm in a situation whereby if I am told that my son's dysplasia does require surgery, who am I trusting to do that? Where am I going to have that done? How is that going to happen? Like, I feel my trust is completely broken. You know, I've been told, I was told from the beginning that his dysplasia is worse than my eldest daughter's, but I was also told in the maternity hospital that I attended that he was on the cusp of having dysplasia and they weren't sure that they were going to refer him to Temple Street. And they did refer him because of the family history. And when I got to Temple Street, then he was braced and I was very upset and I spoke to the consultant at the time about that and said, you know, just to let you know, this is what's happened. I was told that he's on the cusp. I wasn't expecting him to be put in a brace today. And, you know, I'm very upset. This is my second experience of this. So, you know, I'm less upset than I was the first time around because I've had an experience here before. But, you know, it is very upsetting. And the consultant in Temple Street told me, you know, you should express that to Hollis Street. I did express it to Hollis Street. I wrote them a letter. You know, encouraged by him to do that. But I don't know now who's right, consultant in Hollis Street, consultant in Temple Street. You know, if I go to this other third party now, the private consultant that I'm seeing, and they say, yes, I would be keeping him on a surgery list. I would, you know, where does that leave me? I don't know, you know.
Which is the...
I really don't know.
Which is the phrase so many people have been using. Emily, do you have to pay for the second opinion?
Yes, I do, yeah.
That should be reimbursed by the state. If anyone, everyone should be offered a second opinion and it should be reimbursed by the state. Anyway, Emily, onwards and the kind regards to you and your wonderful family and Hayley also. 51551.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Revamp your home this May with our fresh new curtain and bedding designs. Discover comfort and style for every room.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
The ads and the footage on YouTube about the new trains that Ian Road Éireann have got from the Dublin Dart Coastal Route, as they're calling it, and they look fantastic. But Nigel Maloney, what did you spot? What's missing?
Well, Joe, how you doing? I tell you what it is, Joe. They don't have any toilets on board. And that's a bit of a concern for me because none of the stations between Dublin and Drogheda have any toilets on them either. So there's no toilet facilities. And at the moment, one of the things that myself and a lot of people that I know of, the reason we use the train rather than take the bus is that there are toilet facilities on board.
Good point. Now, how long is the journey?
It's roughly an hour from, well, I get off at Laytown, so it's roughly an hour from Conley Station to Laytown Station.
Ian Road Air will say, use the toilets in Conley before we get on.
Yeah, that's fair enough, but sometimes I get on at Tower Street and there's no toilets at Tower Street.
There isn't anything.
No, there's not. And you could be waiting for, like, say, 10 minutes before the train arrives. And it's especially, Joe, when if you've been out socialising and all that, it can be quite inconvenient on the way home on the train. But also, I've noticed when you'd be travelling into Dublin on the train, quite a lot of people use the facilities on board on their way in, especially people with young children and if there's a pregnant lady on board as well, like they would use the toilets as well. But then there's also people with medical conditions and people who are undergoing different treatments and that. So, like, for example, like somebody with diabetes would need to use the toilet on a regular basis or may at short notice need to use a toilet. So if you're on a train for an hour and there's no toilet facilities, that could be quite concerning.
Mm-hmm. They say the new DART... This is Irish Rail. The new DART, just like the old DART, the existing DART, some of those carriages have been there, I think, since 1974. We really got our money's worth out, in fairness. Whoever bought them did the country some service. Existing DARTs don't have toilets. That's the Ian Road Aaron answer.
Yeah, and that's fair enough, because usually you're on the dirt for maybe 10, 12 minutes or maybe even 15 minutes or something like that between most, for most journeys that you do. But in between, if you did need to leave the train for any reason, there's stations in between as well. It's a different story when you're out on the main line, and it's like I said, you can be on the train for 15, 20 minutes before you come into another station. But then even when you do come into those stations, there's no toilet facilities. Now, I have gotten on to the National Transport Authority, and they say that there is plans to put toilets into some of the stations so that you won't have to go more than 20 minutes between stations, which is fair enough. And in my opinion, there should be toilets.
The train isn't going to wait for you.
Well, that's the other thing I was going to say. If you're on it on the last train home and you need to get off, well, you're going to be left wherever you are, kind of thing. So it's not really a good thing. Now, I'm really happy that Éireann Road Éireann are bringing in the new stock and that they're extending the DART, DART Plus, as they call it, out to Drogheda. I think that's a great thing, and it's a great facility to have.
And the condition of the current toilets and the current rolling stock, maybe that's an issue.
Well, the toilets on the current rolling stock, if anything, could be improved, but at least you have got toilet facilities. Like, we had a situation there, as you may remember, where the DART broke down outside
Bray Airshow.
Yeah, well, if you're on a train for 2 hours or something like that, and there's no toilet facilities, you're going to be in a very uncomfortable position. Especially if you have like an overactive bladder, or if you have prostate issues or anything like that, you know. I know quite a few people younger than me as well who, when they found out that there wasn't going to be toilet facilities on the new rolling stock, that they were quite concerned about it. I think the main thing here is that, like, when I did first contact Éireann Road Éireann about it, I was informed that there had been public consultation available. But I've since spoken to people who were at that, and they weren't aware that the toilets were actually not going to be on the new trains coming in. They saw
Hang on now. We have a statement from Éireann Road Éireann. Somebody is contradicting somebody here. We had focus groups. You say you know people went to them. These focus groups established that toilet facilities were not a significant priority for customers.
Okay.
And you're saying what your friends told you was they didn't know there was no
They had gone to these meetings, and they had looked at the drawings, they'd seen the nice comfortable carriages and all the rest of it. They weren't aware that there was no toilet facilities planned for them. Me personally, I didn't go to the meeting because I'm, and that's what you would call a regular user. I'd be an infrequent user. But had I known that that was up for discussion, I definitely would have gone to it. So what I'm saying is, maybe a lot of the people who were at those focus groups and that, it wasn't a concern for them. But I would think that, like I'm in my 60s now, and when I went to socialise with people in Dublin, where I used to work, and with the people that I used to work with and friends and that, keeping in touch with them, when I'm coming home, I have a choice. I could take the bus or I can take the train. Yeah. And the train is a little bit less convenient for me, but I take it because there's toilet facilities on board. And if you've been out socialising with your friends...
Yeah, I take that point. They say,
it's a long way to go.
But hang on, Ian Rhoda, this is in black and white here. Some feedback indicated that toilets detracted from the overall travel experience on DART stroke commuter type trains. Now, I say it'll be a bigger distraction, people dancing as they try and hold till they get to Drogheda.
They say, I'm not with you there.
No, they say, well, neither am I. I don't know what Ian wrote in or actually saying here. Indeed. As the toilets are not separated from the general customer area, as would be the case on intercity trains, people were hardly looking for urinals or whatever in the middle of a carriage. Some feedback indicated they distracted from the overall travel experience on DART commuter type trains, that having a loo on these new trains would detract from the overall travel experience. But the overall travel experience, from what you're saying, and it's common sense, if you're on a journey for an hour, go could be you sitting there with your legs crossed or dancing, trying to wait to get the dog to jump off and hit the loo.
Yeah. Again, Joe, maybe it's just me, but sometimes when I'm in a place where I don't know where the toilet facilities are, it's constantly on my mind looking for them just in case I do need to use them or anything like that. I don't know about most people, but that's just me personally. But like, so if I was on the train and I knew I couldn't get off the train and I needed to use a bathroom, I would find that very concerning for the whole journey. So much so it would possibly put me off using the train.
Now, I was in a motorway service station recently and they were selling, because it was the Dublin to Wexford motorway and it can bung up a lot, especially around Kilmacanog for, depending, you know, if I'm or even the M50, if something happens, you could be sitting there for an hour. But they were actually selling a container. Now, obviously for men who were stuck in the car to do a pee.
Yeah, well,
you'd be arrested.
Yeah,
and you couldn't do a Gerard Depper do on the plane. Remember, he stood up in the middle of the aisle.
No, that wouldn't be appropriate either.
And the sluice gates of Ardna Crusher. Oh, he was arrested, or thrown off. But the sluice gates of Ardna Crusher opened in the middle of the aisle, but he wasn't bothered. But anyway, that's their position. So, I can't.
But my concern for it is that I don't think a lot of people realise that use that the line that actually use it even on a daily basis or on an infrequent basis. I don't think they realise that this was something that was coming down the line.
I wonder, are toilets abused on trains? Is that the issue? Could that be the issue? Well, if we've toilets on these trains, we could end up them getting stuck in Drogheda while we clean out the loo and fix this and fix that. Whereas the less...
Again, Joe, anytime I've used the train, I have to say the toilet facilities have always been there and they function well. And I haven't witnessed any sort of vandalism or anything like that to the toilets. To be honest with you, they're very sturdy, they're very robust, they're built to allow for anything like that. So, but it is something, and again, like you said, like, okay, they might sell those things at service stations or something like that, but again, there's the ladies that use the train as well, and that wouldn't be convenient for them either.
Yeah, and ladies, women might have to use the loo more often for various reasons, for privacy reasons. Nigel. Well, but that, as the fella said, that train has left the station without the jacks.
Well, just on that, Joe. Just before you finish up, what I was saying was, I know they say that they've all the stock ordered and that the new rolling stock, and it's going to be they're going to start using it, testing it from next year onwards, and that. But there's no reason why they couldn't order in carriages that do have toilets on board that can be integrated into the trains once they are up and running.
Can I suggest something else? Because trains have to be ordered 10 years in advance and all this carry on. Mm-hmm. Why don't they, in the meantime, because there are no loos between Connolly and Drogheda, why don't they install portaloos in various stations?
Well, in fairness, they have said that they're going to reopen the toilets in Balbriggan and...
Yeah, but there are high-quality portaloos now available. And why can't they install... In the meantime, it would be a very reasonable way to address the issue, even in the short term.
True, yes, that would be.
Okay.
Anyway, Joe, thanks very much. Nigel,
safe travelling, Nigel. Yes, safe travelling.
Thank you very much.
Good, Margaret.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Bill Slattery says Lahinch in County Clare is going down to Swanee. Why? Bill, why?
Hello, Joe.
Bill.
Joe, how are you doing? Sorry, yes, Bill Slattery here.
I had
a motion in last week. I'm a local county councillor here in Lahinch. I was born and reared on the promenade in Lahinch. And I am just a bit disappointed the way our car park, and we haven't a very big car park in Lahinch for the amount of people that's coming in there at the moment, especially there in the fine weekends or in any day it's fine, even with day trippers. And the influx of, not camper vans, but there are professional camper vans that are fully equipped with toilet facilities and chemical toilets and the whole lot. But we have certain vans coming in that are not converted, and they may have a mattress in the back of them, or they might have something for sleeping overnight. And we have only provision in our car park in Lahinch for five camper vans. But unfortunately, last weekend, the fine weekend, and there's no overnight parking allowed, even for those five camper vans.
Okay.
So last weekend, we had 32 camper vans overnighting on Friday night and Saturday night. And some of them, not all of them, had no proper tile facilities. And a lot of them don't, and a lot of them do. And I'm not painting everyone here with the same brush. I know we have beautiful camper vans coming in with professional people, and they know how to look after their...
But still, Bill, in fairness, you're right. They have to be emptied as well.
Yes, they have to be emptied, but they're emptying their waste into our public toilets.
Yeah.
And it's not right, and for the environment, and even for the people going in using the public toilets. And the car park has been totally blocked. Now, we had bylaws, but they're not being enforced. And so, again, the parking charges. You can park, if you come down, Joe, with your car, you're charged €2 for 3 hours in Lahinch to park for 3 hours. But a camper van can come in for 10 hours and pay €4. Right. But when the traffic warden goes away at 6 or 6:30, that camper van stays overnight and comes out again the following morning at 10 o'clock. And gets another ticket for €4. So they can stay for 5 days for €20 with no facilities and block up the whole promenade in the whole car park in Lahinch. And that was my point of coming across with my motion there last week.
But why would the camper vans, or indeed the other vans, and there's a lot of them, you're right, especially after COVID, people, there's an upsurge in the porches, which are very expensive, but also people banging together the back of the Ford Transit or the Mercedes Sprinter and turning it into a makeshift. But why should they pay more when they're getting no facilities?
But you see, they shouldn't be there because the facilities aren't there. And that's the reason that there's no overnight parking allowed, because we don't have the facilities. And what I'm trying to do here is to put pressure on Clare County Council to provide a designated site with all the facilities that we can push camper vans overnight, 20 or 30 of them, with all the facilities.
But Bill, we've been hearing this for 20 or 30 years.
Yes. Yeah, but Clare County are listening to me, and I'm a local representative.
And what do they say? Do they say we don't have the money, we don't have the...
Yeah, they say we don't have the money, or we're not in that type of business. If somebody wants to provide a camper van site, which we have one or two people in the area that are willing to invest in providing camper van sites, but the council are telling me that no, we won't give planning permission because they're in a scenic route or this or that. And as you know, Lahinch property is at a premium in Lahinch, even to buy anything. Yeah. So I'm having difficulty trying to convince Clare County Council, even though they commissioned a survey last year that this was badly needed in North Clare, let it be Liscannor or Lahinch or Listunvarna or someplace. But yes, the wheel is not there for them to provide
it. Okay. Joe at RT.ie. Hang on with me, Bill. You're very good. Appreciate Joe at RT.ie. Aaron, it's not the third secret of Fatima that there are no facilities for camper vans in Ireland, is it?
No, it's well known at this stage. Yeah. Sure, we must be on with you every second year about the same thing. Lack of facilities. There are fabulous campsites in Ireland, Joe. Mm-hmm. Fabulous campsites in Ireland. But there are no facilities like that chap was saying about that county councils could provide for us. And the money we would bring to a small town or village over a weekend is astronomical.
And why? Why is it not improved?
Listen, that chap can't even answer that. And he's a local councillor. There's no answer. They just don't want us. Not every town, no, not every county. There are towns and counties that have looked after us and are delighted with the extra income over the weekends and during the week, because there are retired people and young people that go camping. Yeah, I go camping any day of the week. There's no answer, Joe. I've had this conversation on your show with Katie and on other radio stations. There's no answer. Nobody will give us a definitive answer. So there's the councillor can't even get a definitive answer from his council.
John Whelan, good afternoon.
Hi, Joe.
Have you an answer?
I do. The councillor Bill there is missing a golden opportunity. Instead of complaining and blaming camper van owners, he should get the council to do their job.
Because he says they won't do it. Bill is blue in the face.
He's blaming the wrong people. I go to Lahinch every week. I'm as well known down there in my camper van as a begging ass. And surfing is a huge economic boom to Lahinch. And you go to Joe's Cafe, Spoonies on the Prom, Randaddy's, Kenny's Pub, music, food all day. I mean, the taverns and the shops and the businesses in Lahinch all welcome the surfers and the camper vanners, who are an economic driver. So instead of complaining about it and putting up barriers, he should be looking for them to put up facilities. And campervan owners have no problem paying a tenner a night to park up, and to all they're asking is for a fresh water pint. And the place down there, there's a great new public toilet block in Lahinch, and I agree, no one should tip their toilet cassette into the public toilets. But around the back, all you have to do is put a service area where you can do that as part of the facilities, and it's a win-win. And all over France, in some of the loveliest cities in the world, La Rochelle, Nantes, Biarritz, they do this right beside five-star hotels. This is it. We should be pushing it up the door. And up the door, up the road in Ennis Diamond is Van der Lust, campervan builders. One of the great expertise and local employer designing and building camper vans as a local business. So, you know, they're coming at it from the entirely wrong direction.
County Council, it's not our job to run camping sites, sir.
Oh, no, that's not true. The thing is that in every city in Europe, every town and village in France,
half of them can't build a house.
Well, then we shouldn't have art centres or swimming pools if we go down that road either. So, look, the thing is that all this is an earner. It can be an economic driver, an employer, and raise funds for the local authority. It need not be a drain.
By the way, if I register a camper van, if I convert to Ford Transit or Sprinter or whatever,
yes,
I do it myself. You know, you can buy stuff. Do I have to re-register that as a camper van?
Yes, you do. Yes. Yes, you do. And there's a VRT tax. And that way, you're paying again into the economy, and then you're registered and qualified to drive a camper van, and it's competent and verified and certified as so. So there's none of this councillor said.
Reverse there for a few minutes, John, a few seconds. How much, follow the money, how much does the government get when you, what did you buy a new camper van, what did you do?
No, so I got a Ford Transit van, what you'd call a builder's van or a panel van.
Yeah, great van.
In the garage in Portlaoise, and went to Ennis Diamond to Dave Hanley and his team, and they do up a design for you, Joe, like if you're doing a fitted kitchen.
Brilliant.
And they show you, look, here's what'll fit. And in the van, he tells me every millimetre is important real estate. You have to maximise all your space.
Yeah.
I have a toilet, shower, cooker, fridge, two beds, and a roof rack for the surfboards, a bike rack for the bikes, and you're all set to go.
So you got that done?
Yeah, 10 years ago.
And what did the government take off you for improving your van?
What they do is they add the price of the van with off the invoice to the price of the fit-out off the invoice, and they lamp you with a 13.3% VRT tax on top of that. So, you know, it is a hefty price tag on top of the other costs. But then you're on the road. And
I know, the freedom of it. I'd love it. Martin O'Brien.
Hello.
You want to talk about your site. Go ahead.
Well, Joe, the last time you were down in St. Mullins was when you had Pixie. Back in 1993, remember that?
Pixie, my dog, yes. Long deceased.
Down in St. Mullins, we're here down here in the Barrow Blue Way.
Okay, beautiful.
We're the last down along there. And up in Guadamani, a camper van site for 70 camper vans.
Brilliant. I know we've spoken, yes. It's brilliant, apparently.
Yeah. Now, from our point of view, we're 5 miles down the river. And as you know yourself, we're the last stop on the Barrow Line.
Mm-hmm.
And most of them, two in the back of them. And the people that walk down, cycle down, and bring fantastic business to the area. But the advantage that Greater Manor has is that they have a proper designated site right in the middle of a village.
Yeah.
And the camper vans have brought huge finance. Not alone to Greater Manor, but to the whole area
and
around.
And who runs the camper van site in Gray?
It's a management group, but very much in cooperation with Kilkenny County Council. So Kilkenny County Council really got behind it. Mm. And it's right on the banks of the river. And all the canoes come through there. So from our business here would be camper vans, canoes, and cyclists coming down along the Barrow River path, which is, you know, a fantastic facility. But I don't know, at the time you described St. Mullins as being the Brigadoon of County Carlow. And it was very much, I think you were in the pub the time you were down here.
You have better memory than I have, Martin.
You were in the bank when I saw the article. You were there on the bank holiday weekend, and there was two lads in the pub. Now that has changed. You know, we're actually on the map now.
Great.
Well, we have a park here which is belongs to Waterways Ireland, and we've got camper vans coming in here.
Well, Martin, is there any way capitalism can kick in here and people set up their own camper vans sites and make money out of them legitimately?
Absolutely. Absolutely, but the actual setting up of a camper van site is a bloody expensive thing.
Oh, is it? Okay.
Because you're into putting, you have to put hard stands in, you have to put in a sewerage facility. Now, if you're in a village, you'll find that there's already a sewerage facility into which you can work. Mm. If you're doing that camper van site out in the middle of nowhere, now you're into putting in a whole sewerage system, hard stands, whatever else. It's a very expensive game. Where councils, as man mentioned earlier, if you go to France, mm-hmm. they have them everywhere. But you need to have the facilities. But I look at the pubs around here and the restaurants, they would be closed if it wasn't for that.
Okay, well, this is pretty. The logic is there. Why isn't the action? Peter Steedman, stay with us, Martin. Peter Steedman.
Okay.
Peter.
How's it going, Joe?
Your point, please.
The councils here are just—they're whistling in the wind, really. Because if they build the facilities, there'll be more. The hotels are too expensive for the ordinary Joe Soap with mm-hmm. a couple of kids. He has a camper van or a caravan, whatever it is, and he's going around. They're spending money when they get into the towns. I spent a month in France last year, and the most expensive site I was in was €45.
Yeah.
For the two of us.
And that's a fully serviced.
That's mains electricity, sewerage, toilets, washing machines, tumble dryers, the works. And that one was run in by the local authority, the local council. And there's a website you can go on to when you're going to France, and it shows you all the ones that are between €6. That was the cheapest one we were in, was €6 a night.
And where's your favourite place in Ireland while I have you?
Oh, it'd be up north. Tullymore Park.
Okay, in Northern Ireland. Who runs that?
That's the local council.
Yeah.
And that's got everything. Showers, toilets, washing machines, the works. And you're right in the village. Beautiful walks around the lakes and everything else. But if instead of the local authorities giving out, it doesn't take much. If the sewerage is there, you're only connecting up to the sewerage. And you don't have to, like the hard stands, they don't have to be concrete. They can be dry filling. And so long as you've got to let, you don't even, most of the campers, I've got solar panels. So I've got 240 volt, even if I'm in the middle of a field.
And
so I can run my microwave, I can run my air fryer, my coffee machine, everything off the solar panels.
Brilliant. And the life, anyone who gets a camper van loves it, don't they? They really love it. And as you say, every millimetre is real estate in it. And I love all the gadgets and the little folding discs and clip out
discs. I was up north last week for the Northwest 100 or 200, the motorbike racing.
Yeah.
And around the town, there must have been 500 camper vans parked on the grass verge.
Wow.
And the council, a big, huge toilet in the middle of the place where you could empty your chemical toilet and everything. It doesn't take much. It does not take much. And the money that it would generate. Like, if you charged everybody 25 quid a night for a camper van and you were there for the 5 nights, that's nice money coming into the local authority.
Yeah, and it's good value as well.
Yeah, very good.
Okay, okay, there's the campaign. It goes on and on and on. Peter Steedman, Bill Slattery, Paul Dunn, Martin O'Brien, Aaron Burchell, Gunamila Malka, Joe at RTE.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Some prostate cancer so often on Liveline, and we'll continue to do so. It's so important. But this is not about prostate cancer per se. It's about the advertising campaign, which is on billboards and bus shelters. And as one man said today, give prostate cancer the finger, which is the prostate cancer. I'll explain the ad to you now. How insensitive. Men getting on with it, having a finger inserted in their anus. Imagine the opposite. A breast cancer poster with a squeeze the boob on it. And basically his point is it's over the this ad for prostate cancer is it's in the public domain. Everyone can see it, including children. And it reads, prostate cancer is a real P-R-I-C-K. And the I is your middle finger, which in turn has another meaning as well. And it's, as far as I can see, it's run by the EU and UCD. You'll see it on bus shelters. I've seen it loads of times in the last few weeks. Sarah Ouellette is the country director for Movember. Why did you need to be so expressive in your language, Sarah?
Hi, Joe. Well, firstly, we absolutely understand the concern around kind of language and imagery in public spaces. And the language here is intended to capture your attention and to kind of stop you where you are to take notice of what it is. It's a play on words. The message here is actually about how there's been innovation in testing for an early screening for prostate cancer. So it's about the fact that you can now have an at-home DIY finger prick test.
Yeah,
so we'll test
fine,
your blood, sent back into...
But everyone, and I take the point about it jumped out at me anyway, but yeah. I'm of that age and I do have a regular, but these are on the public street. And
absolutely.
The word prostate cancer is a real P-R-I-C-K with the middle finger as the I. And surely a child or whatever would say to the parent, what does that mean?
Because
they would have heard that word, P-R-I-C-K, especially young children in school. They would have heard that to refer to their genitalia.
Well, I think there's a few things here. So one is that we know that when we're trying to reach men with health messages, we've done lots of testing at Movember, but also specifically for this study, we spent almost a year actually going through focus groups, talking to men, particularly in the age group of 50 to 69, who were that target age group for prostate cancer testing. And we asked them, how do we capture your attention? What is the way that we get you to think about taking part in like early screening, making sure that you're thinking about and they consistently told us, we want straight talking, we want humor, and we want no sugarcoating. And so that's what we've done here with the creative.
And did any of them say we want vulgarity?
Well, they all saw this ad, and so we tested a bunch of creative
concepts. They're all men of a certain disposition, certain demography that you're aiming at. But this ad is aimed at everybody. It's out on the public street. It's a big campaign. And I'm sure it's an expensive campaign. These are big posters. These are not posters in golf clubs, rugby clubs, GAA clubs, soccer clubs, men's sheds or whatever. These are posters aimed at everybody. And it reads, prostate cancer. We can't say that word on RTE in the context that you're using it, if you follow me, or that there's a double entendre there, obviously. Prostate cancer is a real P-R-I, the middle finger, C-K. And we all know the connection. But Sarah, it's aimed, everyone. Could you not have focused it more on, we know a particular demographic, it's aimed at men, at a particular age, and could we not have focused on them?
We have done so. Interestingly, we are focusing, and you will see this ad and this creative where men are. So we have this going into pubs, onto beer mats.
No, I know that. But this thing, this man on Twitter says it's on the street. It is on the street. It's not in the pub.
It's on the street for two reasons.
And by the way, the middle finger, as portrayed in this billboard and bus shelter, the middle finger is the middle finger that people use to abuse each other in terms of signage. Was that deliberate as well?
The intention there is around the finger prick test is the key message mm-hmm. there. So that's what we're focusing on. And the imagery, whilst it is attention grabbing, I understand that for some people that will be, it will absolutely be disruptive. It's intended to capture your attention to look at the difference now that there is a different, that you don't have to look at the invasive testing of previous times. You'd have to be tested for prostate cancer, that there is innovation. It's easier and it's removing the barriers for men.
Then why couldn't the ad just simply read, With a photograph of this new little blood test, why can't the ad just simply read, same size, a simple finger prick blood test you can do at home can detect prostate cancer early? What was wrong with that wording?
So that information.
Why did you have to put prostate cancer as a real prick with the middle finger? It'd be great to see all the kids doing the middle finger now to their parents. But I'm a half devil's advocate. Like, where does it stop this? This use of, I think this program more than most is an alert on prostate cancer, but in the public domain, and sir, this is not, you're doing an incredible job, but in the public domain, is there any limits on what can be said and what cannot be said and what words can be used and what signs can be used? Or does the end always justify the means?
I think this is an important message, and it's important that we know, and this is not just us saying this, this is actually mm-hmm. through evidence and research, that we know the way to get to men is to use humor. And whilst I appreciate that this is out in a wider context, we have to reach men where they are, and it's not just going to be in those spaces like GA clubs or like pubs. It's going to be out mm-hmm. where they're commuting, where they are listening to the radio. Okay. And so to do that, we have to reach an important message to land, because as you've said, you've been shining a spotlight on prostate cancer, and the impact that it has on people across Ireland is enormous. And if we can get men...
We've done it so many times and we'll keep doing
it.
But that's not the issue here. That is not the issue here. The issue is, how does the end always justify the means in terms of the use of certain language in public spaces? Maybe it does. I know the world has changed. I went into a shop the other day and it was pointed out to me by a parent who happened to be a woman. She said to me, did you see that bubble gum there that they're now selling in kiddie shops? And it's an image of a camel from behind. And the bubble gum, which is aimed at kids because it's 5 cents, the bubble gum is called, again, I can't say the second word in this context, it's called camels. And as I said to Shay earlier, the other word you're looking for is to do with soccer at GAA. But that's where it's openly and displayed as by a set of camels' testicles, so to speak. And there's the camel with the testicles well endowed. And the mother just said to me, like, you're bringing kids. It's aimed at children. Is there no, and there can't be any law, obviously, hopefully, but is there no limits to the use of shock?
Well, I think in this case, it is a very different case. We aren't just trying to sell a product here. We are actually trying to deliver an important message. You've been talking about prostate cancer. You know that, like, it is very hard to reach men and have them engage in their health. It is really hard. And what all of our research for years and years has shown us is that the way to do that is humor. And in this particular case, and we tested this ad, and no comments came back about it being offensive. In fact, it was about...
Well, when did it roll out? I only saw it at the weekend. It's actually just started.
So it's a week in. And I should point out, this is a study. So it's not going nationwide. This is in very specific areas. So in Dublin, and it'll be in Waterford as well. We're doing a study to see how we can get men to engage with this early screening study. So it is about... We know that historically, men have very low rates of engaging with early screening programs. Yeah. So how do we get them to take the moment to think, I got that letter through the mail that says I'm eligible for this study. I'm not going to just throw it in the bin or ignore it. I'm actually going to go back to it and have a look and possibly then send in my finger prick test, look and see what the results are and take that process further. And we know that 1 in 6 men are going to have prostate cancer in their life. If we can get them detected early, treated early, it's going to have better outcomes for everyone men and the people who love them. So
okay.
I understand that this is a campaign, but it works.
Yeah. And I know there's no argument against that, but my point still stands. Does the use of certain images, words in certain contexts that we could not use here on air, where there's children listening, is it okay to use them in the public domain and being paid for by the taxpayer? Phelim Warren, Phelim.
Hello, Joe.
You're in favour. You say, were you aware? Were you aware? Have you had your prostate cancelled or checked even?
Well, Joe, briefly, as brief as I can, I only saw that ad an hour and a half ago.
Yeah, it only rolled out this weekend, yeah.
Yeah, and I'd like to shake Sarah's hand over the airways for mm-hmm. putting that out there. Whoever put that out there needs to be highly commended and highly praised, because I'm 19 months into treatment for high-grade inoperable prostate cancer, Joe.
Oh, God.
And the time for pussyfooting around men's health is over.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you think, Joe, children are upset looking at that advertisement, given what they're exposed to every day of the week on their phones, on their computers, on their television. If you think that is vulgar, Joe, I have some magic beans to sell you. That ad is absolutely outstanding.
Okay, I take that point.
It is outstanding, Joe. It's a genius play on words, Joe. It's a brilliant play on words, and I think the middle finger okay. has more than one connotation. The middle finger, for me, is although cancer must be respected. Since my diagnosis, Joe, this was a full-on battle of me against inoperable aggressive cancer. And I was giving cancer, and I continue to give cancer, not only the middle finger, I give it the two fingers. I give it everything, because I think that message might finally hit home to men, not only men your age, Joe, not Joe Biden, who's 82 and who had the same Gleason score as me, and I was 25 years Joe Biden's junior when I was diagnosed in September 2023. A good mate of mine was diagnosed age 44. Prostate cancer is no respecter of age.
Nobody in their right mind could argue about that, but that's not the debate, but obviously...
Okay, well, we'll get back to the debate, Joe. We'll get back to the debate, right? So, my granddaughter, who I'm exceptionally close to, she was 7 years of age when I broke the news to her that granddad has this very aggressive, dangerous, life-threatening prostate cancer. I sat her down and I explained it to her, what I have, where it is, what needs to be done, and that granddad would be fine. Now, if someone's child sees that tomorrow and says, Daddy, what's that? Well, then daddy or mammy looks them in the eye and says, this is what it's about, pet. Now, the children, okay. Joe, including my granddaughter, are hearing that word that you cannot say on air. I bring her to Shamrock Rovers matches the last 3 years.
That's not the comparator. That's not the comparator. That's not the comparator, and neither is your porn on a smartphone.
This point is important. My granddaughter hears that language every single week going to football matches, and she hears words. She hears that P word, she hears the F word, okay. She hears the B word, and that is the nature of the times we live in, Joe. And if someone is offended by that ad, they really need to look at their life choices and their sensitivity, because that ad, as I said, I think Sarah needs to be 100%.
And you've said that, and she's taken and
100%
lots of
praise about Sarah, that. I think it's superb.
Sarah, this ad does not invite me to do anything, because it doesn't say apply here for your free finger prick little blood test. It says, if you get a letter inviting you to participate, please sign up. So who's going to get the letters?
Yeah, so this is part of the study approach, right? So this is not a broad screening program for everyone.
That's what I mean. I can't walk up. That ad is not telling me, go into the chemist next door and get a free finger prick test. Sure it isn't.
No, but what it is saying is, and we see it, and the evidence shows
this. No, what it's saying is there will be a selected group of men who will get a letter, and please reply to the letter.
And there's a reason for
but
that.
You've already,
Joe, so
hang on, but you've already, you are, therefore, you already know who this ad is aimed at, because you're going to send out letters to addresses.
So we know that it's going, we don't, so what happens is there's two things here. One is the broader piece around getting tested for prostate cancer is an important message. So even if you aren't invited to this study, the fact that you've seen it, the fact that you've noticed it, the fact that we're talking about it, this is going to get men getting tested for prostate cancer full stop. And that's great. Secondly, if you are one of the 8,000 to 10,000 men who are going to get this letter to the mail, we know from studies before that many men don't respond to that. They simply ignore that message and they don't take part in these early screening studies. Exactly. So if this is that I've got that letter through the mail and now I've also seen this poster or I've seen this beer mat or I've heard this radio advert, it's going to land. It's going to land with more men. And so the idea is, can we get, and the study here is testing, can we get more men engaging with these screening programs so that they are getting detected early? And if so, is this the way that we do it? Do we use this type of messaging? Do we reach them through these methods, through posters or through beer mats?
Why not just in every pharmacy or in every pub or in every golf club, soccer club, gar club, why not give a free finger prick little container?
And that's, this may end up being the catalyst for that. But this is the test. This is the test to see, does this work? And it's also beyond men, right? So if you have a father or a brother or, you know, all those people in your life who might see this ad as well, it's beyond just the men themselves. So that's why it's important for us that, yes, it is a bold message we're going out with, and it is eye-catching, but that's all designed to be that way. And it's important because it's an important, serious message.
So how are these men are going to get these emails? You've already decided who they are. How are they picked?
So this is in partnership with UCD. It's in partnership with the EU. Our part in the study is to create, we've developed the ads and the strategy around it to support that piece of work. But the rest of it, the men who are selected, the way that their samples of blood are being analyzed, all of that is happening through our partners at UCD and through hospitals.
But how are they picking the men? How are they picking the men?
It's by your age range. So 50 to 69 is the age range. And then it is... it is particularly randomly selected, so you're not.
Okay.
It's a study, so it is intended to be that way. And I should say we're doing it here in Ireland, and we're supporting UCD in this work. This is an EU initiative. It's about working in other places.
And as I said, the issue, and nobody can argue against encouraging people to be it breast cancer, cervical, or whatever, to getting tested. Okay, good to meet Margaret, Sarah, Ouellette, and also people know. Movember, which is a brilliant idea, and Phelan Warren, Phelan onwards, and best wishes to you and your family, especially your gorgeous granddaughter. Joe at RT.ie.
Thanks for having me on. Thanks.
Joe Duffy.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Legendary Greg Allen is on the line. Greg of our sports department. Greg, good afternoon.
Afternoon, Joe.
You say, I didn't notice, you have to have a finger prick test, blood test, 10 times a day.
Yeah, for 23 years. I was diagnosed type 1 diabetic. I was covering a golf tournament actually in London in 2001, and they had a men's health sort of tent there to test men's health.
Brilliant.
And I was diagnosed there, and I've been under the care of St. Colum Kills and Lock Town ever since. And I'm a type 1 diabetic. I have until recently, I've gone on the insulin pump recently, but I have been finger prick testing for 23 years, about 10 times a day, just to make sure that you always, you have to monitor your blood so that you know the amount of insulin to inject. And as a result of that, I would always use, and this is the irony in this, I would always use the longest finger on my hand, which is obviously the finger used in that advert. One of the reasons being it has the deepest padding, and so when you prick every time you but literally it hurts a little bit. So every other finger doesn't offer the same amount of blood vessels as that finger does. Only reason I use it.
And when you finger prick the longest finger, Greg, if you're doing it 10 times a day, are you doing it in the one spot?
Well, I use the fingers of both hands. You negotiate your way around the tip of the finger, and then obviously it heals after a certain period of time, and you go there again. It's just the way it is.
Now, you also say you have to be monitored for prostate cancer. Why is that? Now, everyone has, I agree, but is there a particular concern?
Well, under the care that I have in St. Colum Kills and Loughlinstown, one of the blood tests, the routine blood tests I had about 8 years ago, determined that my PSA had risen quite sharply from around 1.5 to 3.5 between blood tests. And from that point onwards, I have been under the care of a urologist, and I've had full prostate care in terms of a biopsy and two MRI scans, and I have my next visit is fairly shortly with my specialist, my consultant. So I we all get to a certain age, Joe. When you have running repairs, it's like a car with 120,000 kilometers on the clock. You just have to take care of yourself as much as possible. But Joe, the point I'd like to make is that there might be some outrage at this, because other advertisements may well use, outrage for the wrong reason. But in this case, it is so warranted. Anything that gets the attention of men who are not particularly good in general, it's a bit of a cliche, at looking after the health, anything that gets their attention, if it helps to save or improve the health of even one, then it's worth it.
I know, but I want to see this. I want to see this new finger prick test free in every pharmacy. That man just picked it up.
This finger prick, it's an absolute game changer, this finger prick test, because PSA testing isn't hugely accurate as it is. It is just a guess really, to show that you may have a predisposition towards having prostate cancer. But this finger prick test is now something that everybody be able to get. Hopefully it will be rolled out in pharmacies. Hopefully that will happen in time. The sooner the better.
Here, here. Do you know, Greg, that you have finger pricked yourself nearly 90,000 times?
Well, isn't the body wonderful at repairing damaged tissue such as your? I have used other fingers, but it hurts. It hurts far more on the other fingers than it does in the largest finger.
What? It's the first when you wake up in the morning. It's the first thing you do.
Well, I was saying I'm on the pump now for 8 months.
Yeah, what you do?
Up to 8 months ago, yes. It was the first thing I did and the last thing I did at night, and about seven or eight times in between during the day. Every time you eat anything with carbohydrate, especially, you would have just tested to see where you're. And you have a little testing unit, which is the size of an old packet of cigarettes, so to speak, as you carry around with you all the time.
Well, Greg, anyone who sees you on telly at the golf or whatever, and you also do brilliant work in athletics, you're the picture of health.
Well, that's down to the diabetes team and my GP. Yeah. And hopefully my prostate.
And your natural good looks, Greg.
Joke away, will you? Go on.
Stay there for a sec. By the way, I'm interested in that whole idea when you say you went to a golf tournament and there was a men's health tent.
Yeah,
Brilliant idea.
Yeah, and it is. It was, and I tell you something, Joe. I was the last person to go into it on the Sunday. I was the last patient, and they diagnosed me. And things could have happened to me, which would have been possibly not life threatening, but would have been very serious if I hadn't by chance gone into that men's health initiative.
Trypanophobia is a fear of needles. You don't have that, as we discovered during COVID, Greg, on this program, a lot of people have an intense fear of needles. But anyway.
Yeah, and I know them. Yeah, and I really do sympathise with them if they have a condition like mine. But I don't. I'm lucky. It doesn't bother me at all.
Okay. Where are you off to next?
There's a small tournament in America, the US Open, and hopefully we might have a Lowry McIlroy two-pronged attack at the top of the leaderboard,
and
like we had at the Masters, and we didn't have it last major, but it's coming up fairly shortly in a couple of weeks.
But Rory always gives you an interview.
Well, at the USPGA, he didn't speak to anyone.
I know, we know that. But he always looks after Archie, and he's very, very deep. And Shane, of course, as well. But it's great, because I'm sure the Malie afterwards, Greg.
Yes,
okay.
I wonder. He looked after me particularly well at the Masters, I have to say, Joe. Even without knowing what the scenario was going to be, whether he'd win or not, all the way through.
Okay, thanks indeed for that, Greg. Look after yourself. Tommy O'Sullivan, Sound, Richie Byrne Research, producer Annette Egan.